Well, welcome to Left Out. Left Out examines the news and opinions from Left Out from a point of view left out of the mainstream media, public affairs program of WRCT 88.3 FM. I'm Bob Harper.
I'm Danny Slater.
And today's program is produced by Quentin Steinhaus. Listeners are invited to call us as usual at 412-268-9728, or you can send electronic mail to bob@leftout.info.
Well, as usual, we have an announcement to make, which is that you should listen to Democracy Now! Every weekday morning at 8 a.m. on WRCT 88.3 right here. So today's program, we're going to be having a couple of different topics to talk about. Later in the show, we're going to be having a guest from an organization. Well, if we can get him on the phone, afterdowningstreet.org. His name is Jonathan Schwartz. To talk about the Downing Street memo that's starting to get a little bit of traction in the media. We mentioned it here, I think, 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago on Left Out, way early, but months, weeks before it ever got heard of in the U.S. mainstream media. Now it's getting a little bit of publicity, and we'll be talking about that more later in the program. Right now, there's some other interesting testimony that was given by a guy named George Galloway.
Right, also thinly covered in the mainstream media.
Yeah. Do you want to introduce that topic,
sure,
Bob?
So George Galloway is a Scotsman who's a member of British Parliament representing a district in Scotland, who is known to be kind of a firebrand, a bit of a character. In fact, he quit the Labour Party, was basically forced out because of his opposition to the Iraq War and his assertions that the war was poorly conceived, poorly planned, and that the stories about the weapons and so forth were false. He then ran for re-election under his own party and was re-elected whenever the British election was, a month or so ago.
Yeah.
He was elected running under, I can't remember the name of his party, but it was effectively the George Galloway Party. And Galloway was caught up in a bit of a scandal with the business about the Iraq food for oil program. And the short version of it is that various people in the Bush administration and their lackeys in the Congress, including Norm Coleman, are trying to cover up the role of American companies, including Halliburton, in exploiting the food for oil program. And they're trying to pretend that George Galloway, who was running a charity organization and also trying to prevent the war from happening in Iraq, was pocketing millions of dollars in the oil for food program. So Coleman made a little bit of a tactical error and had Galloway come to testify about his involvement, and Galloway snapped up the opportunity and said, "I'll be there tomorrow," and showed up. And Norm Coleman, for those of you who don't know, is one of the wing nuts in Congress. He was elected
upon the death of Paul Wellstone, died in a
plane crash, and so Norm Coleman got in. And I have to say, he's a despicable character. So what we'd like to do to begin with on today's program, while we're waiting to get in touch with our calling guest, is to play a segment of Galloway's testimony from the Hill, for several reasons, one of which is just the sheer pleasure of hearing a very practiced and skillful political orator, and also someone who hands Norm Coleman his head on a platter.
Yeah. Okay.
And also responds quite adequately, and also should be a role model for Democrat politicians opposing these Republicans, where there isn't anyone on the scene coming close who could match this kind of performance. And as we'll come back to shortly later on, we're seeing once again, when we talk a bit about the Downing Street memo and so on, once again what we're seeing is that the British are showing us how politics is done. But let's start out first of all with Galloway's testimony.
Yeah.
It's a proven fact that these forged documents existed and were being circulated amongst right-wing newspapers in Baghdad and around the world in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Iraqi regime. Now, Senator, I gave my heart and soul to oppose the policy that you promoted. I gave my political life's blood to try to stop the mass killing of Iraqis by the sanctions on Iraq, which killed 1 million Iraqis, most of them children. Most of them died before they even knew that they were Iraqis. But they died for no other reason other than that they were Iraqis, with the misfortune to be born at that time. I gave my heart and soul to stop you committing the disaster that you did commit in invading Iraq. And I told the world that your case for the war was a pack of lies. I told the world that Iraq, contrary to your claims, did not have weapons of mass destruction. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that Iraq had no connection to Al-Qaeda. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that Iraq had no connection to the atrocity on 9/11/2001. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that the Iraqi people would resist a British and American invasion of their country, and that the fall of Baghdad would not be the beginning of the end, but merely the end of the beginning. Senator, in everything I said about Iraq, I turned out to be right, and you turned out to be wrong. And 100,000 people have paid with their lives, 1,600 of them American soldiers, sent to their deaths on a pack of lies, 15,000 of them wounded, many of them disabled forever, on a pack of lies. If the world had listened to Kofi Annan, whose dismissal you demanded, if the world had listened to President Chirac, who you want to paint as some kind of corrupt traitor, if the world had listened to me and the anti-war movement in Britain, we would not be in the disaster that we're in today. Senator, this is the mother of all smokescreens. You are trying to divert attention from the crimes that you supported, from the theft of billions of dollars of Iraq's wealth. Have a look at the real oil for food scandal. Have a look at the 14 months you were in charge of Baghdad, the first 14 months, when $8.8 billion of Iraq's wealth went missing on your watch. Have a look at Halliburton and the other American corporations that stole not only Iraq's money, but the money of the American taxpayer. Have a look at the oil that you didn't even meter, that you were shipping out of the country and selling, the proceeds of which went who knows where. Have a look at the $800 million you gave to American military commanders to hand out around the country without even counting it or weighing it. Have a look at the real scandal breaking in the newspapers today, revealed in the earlier testimony in this committee, that the biggest sanctions busters were not me or Russian politicians or French politicians. The real sanctions busters were your own companies with the connivance of your own government.
That was George Galloway, who's a British member of Parliament, who was testifying in Capitol Hill on May 17th to a committee chaired by Norm Coleman, the Honorable Norm Coleman, Senator from Minnesota, who had arranged for Galloway's testimony as part of an accusation based on forged documents that Galloway was involved in the stealing money from the Iraq, from the Oil for Food program prior to the invasion of Iraq, which was nothing other than a smear and a distraction. And Galloway, to his credit, put Norm Coleman in his place. And the thing that it makes you wonder, I mean, there's a distinct pleasure in listening to him deliver those remarks. And in fact, this was only three, 4 or 5 minutes worth. It's actually a 20-minute testimony, and I would recommend to our listeners that you listen to it in full because it's really quite interesting.
It's on the Left Out.
It's on the website. You can get it from leftout.info. You can click to it quite easily and listen to it for yourself. But the real thing, as I said earlier, is that what it really brings up is that why is no one in the U.S. capable? Why is no American politician? Why is no other senator capable of making statements of this kind?
Right.
In plain English, right? And What we've noticed recently, in a small way, which I've been taking some pleasure in, is Howard Dean, now the chairman of the Democratic Party, has been freely making accusations and firing off squibs left and right, which I have been enjoying enormously.
Yeah.
Which begins to get to the level that is necessary. But anyway, Galloway is a really an impressive speaker.
Yeah, of course. Needless to say, that testimony did not get much airplay.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is, you should ask yourself, why is it that you haven't heard this in full? And here's another question for you. It turns out that, unlike all other testimony in Capitol Hill, Galloway's testimony is not, at least the last I checked, I didn't check for a couple of weeks, was not available on the Senate website. I'm sure that Coleman suppressed it because Norm Coleman there was swinging in the breeze while he was being put in his place appropriately by George Galloway. The other thing that it brings to mind as well, and I think many people who have any experience, for example, by watching C-SPAN or who have been to Britain and are aware of the level of political discourse, well, throughout the UK, but also in particular in the British House of Commons, and are particularly familiar with the tradition of Prime Minister's Question Time. Anyone who's seen this, whether on television or live or whatever, knows that. Can you just possibly imagine George Bush ever
succumbing to that,
ever participating in anything resembling the kind of discourse that is done, twice a week in the House of Commons, Prime Minister's Question Time? Never. Total impossibility.
Yeah.
Absolutely impossible. In fact, when Bush visited the UK about a year ago, he specifically avoided going to the House of Commons for fear of being heckled, because he most certainly would be heckled, and he would look like the fool that he is.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Danny.
Yeah. So, I believe that we have Jonathan Schwartz on the line. Is that correct?
Yeah. Hey.
Oh, hi, Jonathan. Sorry for the delay. I'm Bob Harper. You're on Left Out on WRCT 88.3. And this is
Danny Slater.
Thank you for having me on today.
Thank you for being on. Thank you for being on the show.
Is the level okay?
So our audio is maybe not the best here. Let's see if we can get that sorted out.
Go ahead. Say something else, John.
Well.
Okay.
As you may have said already, I am on the show as a representative of After Downing Street, which can be found online at afterdowningstreet.org, and we're an organization group that has been. Families of people who have been killed in Iraq, some veterans of the war who are now back in the U.S., and very concerned with the issue.
John, I think we're having a problem with the audio here. I don't think people can hear you very well. Are you on a cell phone or?
No, I actually am on a regular phone. Is it easier to hear me if I'm speaking a little bit more loudly?
That's a little bit better, but I think the problem is more on our end. The producer is looking into it at the moment.
He's writing a note.
Anyway, right, so you're representing afterdowningstreet.org, and that's a website that we link to from the Left Out webpage, and you can have a look at it. One thing we want
you to hold a few seconds.
Okay.
We'll Bob and I will just talk for a few minutes. Okay.
We'll try to get
your phone hooked up properly.
Dealing with some technical problems here. I'm sorry about that. Thanks. Okay, so where were we? We were talking about Galloway, and we'll get back to our guest in a moment. Apologize to our listeners for that. Please feel free to phone us at 412-268-9728 or send electronic mail to bob@leftout.info if you want to make any comments or call in and talk about any of our topics today in today's program.
I think we can go ahead and introduce the Downing Street.
Go ahead. Yeah, why don't we do that?
Street
yes,
so,
that'll be great.
Well, I wrote a little blurb about this on our webpage. Basically, it says that all along we've been left out here. It's been very clear to us that the U.S. intended to invade Iraq, well, certainly since 9/11, but probably even before that. But at 9/11, that was certainly when the decision began to gel that it was going to actually happen. In fact, Rumsfeld on September 12th wrote notes saying that we have to invade Iraq and stuff. So, all the evidence pointed to this. People who had been
in the cabinet, such as Richard Clark, such as Paul O'Neill, all wrote about this and wrote about the infatuation with Iraq and wrote about how they had made this decision, you know, way before they admitted that they had made the decision. And then came up with this intelligence and WMD, claims of WMDs, terrorist ties, nuclear capabilities, all these things which were used to justify the war.
And that we knew that these things were all, you know, that just looking at the big picture, it was obvious that this was all just a big farce to justify what they wanted to do, which was to invade Iraq. And as a side issue, I just noted in the webpage, which is that a war of aggression is called the supreme international crime
the Nuremberg Tribunal. It says to initiate a war of aggression is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole.
And in any event, if what was unfolding of the last several years, and
reading
the foreign press, reading you know, people like Ray McGovern, reading Scott Ritter, reading all the sources we have
everywhere but the American mainstream media.
Right. It's obvious that this is what happened. Then came the Downing Street memo, which is basically the minutes of a cabinet meeting that took place on July 13th, 2002, in the office of Tony Blair,
They talked about their interactions and knowledge of what was going on in the U.S. and described in detail what the U.S. position was on this. And the memo is very detailed, and it was leaked by somebody and published in the Times of London.
It contains sentences such as,
it seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action. This is in 2002. Also, the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. And the thing about this is that what different makes this different, and hopefully when we get John Schwartz on again, he can tell us as well, is that this is an official source. This is not cannot be attributed to a, quote, disgruntled former cabinet member or like Paul O'Neill who was fired or any other thing. This is an official document of
internal memorandum
yeah. of a meeting that took place
with the Prime Minister.
With the Prime Minister and
Foreign Minister, Minister of Defense.
It is undisputed.
Right.
Nobody has said that's a forgery.
Right.
It's not just nobody has said that.
No,
it's
no,
not
they've
disputed.
Acknowledged
it is
that
a
it's
fact.
Valid.
It is a completely valid official document that completely confirms everything we already believed about this. And the consequences, I mean, if you were able to disregard and believe the hype and the cover-up and the whitewashing about what had happened to WMD, and we're going there to save the Iraqi people and all the lie. I mean, if you're able to believe the lies, then you can't believe them anymore.
Yeah, I mean it's really quite interesting. I mean there are a lot of angles on this, and hopefully we'll talk with John Schwartz about this shortly. But the the main thing is that this came out on May the first, I think it was.
Yes.
And was scarcely covered at all. And actually, this was the second of two leaks, two successive weeks in a row in the UK during the election. So the British elections were May the 14th or something like that, in the middle of May, and this was leaked about a week or two before the before the election, and with clear intent to disrupt Blair's re-election campaign. And the week before, the memorandum that was leaked was an internal document discussing the legality of the war, the fact that the war was patently illegal, and that the various players were concerned about their own liability as war criminals in the event that the invasion took place. So we can pick that back up. I think we now have John Schwartz back on the line. Hello. No, I guess we don't.
We're still hoping to get John on the line.
We're still having trouble. We're still having technical trouble. with getting our caller on the line, so we'll continue discussing. So the what had happened is the first memorandum was a discussion of the legality of the war and the fact that the war was that there was no legal basis for the war and that they were going to have to contrive one. And one of the things that came out in that memo was that the British and American government, and this was then later documented and had been actually previously documented by observations by independent parties, that had escalated the bombing in the no-fly zone, the often misnamed UN no-fly zone, which was really the US-UK no-fly zone in Iraq, in order to provoke Saddam Hussein into doing something that would be, you know, the proverbial casus belli,
yeah,
the cause for war, the justification for the war. But also what was interesting is that the British commander of British forces, whose name I don't have in front of me at the moment, insisted at that time on getting in writing the authorization and the assertion that this was a legal operation. And his own remark was that he wasn't going to go down alone. If he ended up in criminal court because of this, then the other members of the cabinet were going to go with him.
Yeah.
And insisted on getting it in writing. So this is the first thing. First of all, they knew perfectly well that it was illegal. And if they really thought that there were all these weapons, blah, 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 they certainly wouldn't have been too worried about the legality of the war. They knew that the justification for this was regime change. Then you look in the second downstream memo, and it mentions here specifically that the Attorney General said that, I'm quoting, that the desire for regime change was not a legal basis for military action. There are three possible legal bases: self-defense, humanitarian intervention, or UN authorization. So we may have John Schwartz on the line.
Well, I am here.
Ah, there we go. I can hear you. Thank you. That's very good. Good. I'm sorry for the technical problems we've been having.
John, did you hear what we were saying?
You know, maybe you can hear me now. But
I can hear you, yes.
Getting a little bit hard for me to hear you.
Okay.
So I will do my best.
Okay.
I did hear what you were saying.
Okay. So maybe we can pick up. So what we're doing is we're recapping that in the run-up to the British election, there were two successive leaks. There was a leak, the famous one of the Downing Street memo, which I'm sure you'll be happy to summarize for us, was also preceded by another leak in which the British cabinet members were talking about the legality of the war. And I wonder whether you might pick up at that point.
Yes. There are, at this point, a whole slew of documents that are being leaked by someone within the British government.
Okay.
And it is fascinating that this is happening right now, even apart from the issue of Iraq, because it demonstrates that there is someone very high up in the British government, very close to Tony Blair, who is clearly extremely angry and is, frankly, trying to cut Blair's throat and get him kicked out of office. Because these documents are things that really were available only to a very small circle. Now, the most famous one is the one that, as you say, was released in Britain on May 1st in the Times of London. There is also a supporting documentation for that memo, which was about a meeting that took place, as you said, at the end of July in 2002. Now, there are also a group of six documents that are from earlier in 2002 in March, which is members high up in the British government talking to each other about their discussions with officials in Washington and what their take is on what the Bush administration has decided and how they are going to try to persuade the Bush administration that, yes, they are on board for regime change, they know that an invasion is inevitable, but for their own sake, they need the U.S. to pretend to go to the U.N. and make a show of saying that, you know, if Saddam disarms, then we won't invade, knowing all along that this is simply an attempt to create a pretext for war.
Right.
And they really are fascinating to read, all of these. The earlier ones include things in which these high-up British officials are scoffing at some of the American justifications for war. For instance, Peter Ricketts, who is a member of the Foreign Office in Britain, wrote to Jack Straw, who is the Foreign Secretary, essentially the equivalent of our Secretary of State.
Right.
And Ricketts wrote to Straw, U.S. scrambling to establish a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda is so far, frankly, unconvincing. And the U.S. ambassador, the UK ambassador to the U.S., who is Christopher Meyer, wrote to one of the people he worked with that he had explained to Paul Wolfowitz, sure, obviously you guys can invade on your own, but if you want us to go along with you, you need to go to the U.N. And he said in his exact words, you know, said with Wolfowitz, I went through the need to wrong-foot Saddam on the inspectors and the U.N. Security Council resolution. And said, you know, like, if you can go ahead and sort of, like, create some kind of pretext, then, you know, you better believe that we'll be right there with you.
In other words,
and of course, what this shows is that the whole process towards the end of 2002 and the beginning of 2003 was just a charade. They were always going to invade Iraq. It was simply an attempt to generate political support within England for what Blair had already decided on.
So in this respect, I mean, Bush lied to the American people. Bush lied to Congress in pretending that that this decision was not already taken.
That's exactly right, and he's continuing to lie today. As you may have mentioned in the recent press conference when he was finally asked about this, he said nothing could be further from the truth, you know, that we had made a decision at that point.
He'll regret those words.
Yes, it's preposterous for him to make this claim, but he continues to do so.
So I have a question about the UN thing. So they decided they were going to send in the inspectors with the hopes that Saddam Hussein would somehow block the inspectors and create a fuss, and that would give them the pretext for the war. But what actually happened was they actually began successfully inspecting hundreds of sites and found nothing. And then at some point Bush said, I'm running out of patience, and I'm going to invade. Isn't that what happened? I mean, that was one of the reasons why we, like Bob Harper and I, knew that this was all fake, because the inspections were going swimmingly.
Well, that's exactly right. Bush could not wait any longer to invade for several reasons. The first was, and you can read that in these documents, you know, in March of 2002, they were saying the ideal time to invade, you know, would be in the spring of 2003. For various reasons, various military reasons, certainly including the weather, they wanted to invade in the spring. And also, the longer that the inspections went on, finding nothing with no resistance for Iraq, the more tenuous their case for war would become.
And so hence the smearing of the UN.
Go ahead and do it then.
And the smearing of El Baradei and the smearing of Hans Blix and so on. That went on. So I wanted to mention that the memoranda that you're referring to from 2002 are available on the afterdowningstreet.org website, if I'm not mistaken. On the left-hand column, there's key documents, and there's links to these various documents. Is that right?
That is right. Anyone who just wants to read these for themselves, just go to afterdowningstreet.org, and as you say, look on the left-hand column, and you'll be able to check them all out.
I wanted to mention something. Before you came on, I don't know if you heard it, but I was talking about why this is important, why these documents are important. Although, as I said, Bob and I already knew, we already had a belief, these documents are important nonetheless. And so if you could just explain that very quickly. And also, I'd like to hear your response to why the media, what's going on with the U.S. media. Just explain the... Oh, and then the third thing is, to talk about Michael Kinsley's.
Okay, well, okay,
that's a lot of stuff. Sorry.
Get to those in turn.
Okay.
So the first thing, why does it matter?
Why does it matter? Well, you're absolutely right when you say that anyone who has been paying close attention to the news will not be surprised when they read these documents, because there has been an enormous amount of circumstantial evidence that
right.
This is exactly what happened. Nonetheless, you really cannot get more damning than having documents such as this from the very, very highest level of the government. I mean, you know, of course, the only thing that could be more damning would be documents from the U.S. government itself. But this is people who are making the decisions, people who are there in the room talking to each other openly about what their plan was, openly because they never expected that these documents would become public. And that's why it is very, very close to a smoking gun. At the very least, it is definite evidence that a resolution of inquiry is needed. Various people in Congress are now saying that they need to introduce a resolution of inquiry with subpoena power to investigate this and find out if indeed Bush has committed impeachable offenses. Now, number two, why did it take the media so long to notice, and why even to date have they not done a very good job of looking at what the implications are? Well, that's an interesting question, and the answer has all kinds of implications for us. I think, this is my opinion, but I think the evidence is pretty strong that it's true, that everything that you hear when you're in elementary school or maybe a little bit later in high school and taking civics classes about how the media in the United States works and it's, you know, always standing up for the people of government and so forth, just isn't true. You know, I would say people talk about something like this and say, well, you know, the media has failed. But my perspective is, you know, CBS, ABC, The Washington Post, The New York Times don't exist to help people like us understand the world. They're very big corporations, and by law, they exist to make as much money as they possibly can. You know, that's why they're there. And usually, making trouble, confronting the government, costs you money. And, you know, it would be surprising if big corporations ever decided, you know, it would be a good idea for us right now to start losing money. That's just not the way corporations work. So I would say, we talked about the media failing because it has not covered this issue very well. I don't really see it as failure at all. You know, I mean, if you look at their profit and loss statements, I think you'd find that they were doing quite well over the past couple of months. They were making lots of money. And
just depends on what your measure is. Yeah, so it's silly people like us, then, who think that the newspapers should be reporting on these things.
Yeah, the only thing that's irritating about it is that, you know, the newspapers themselves and, you know,
pretend.
Chris Matthews on Hardball and
Hardball.
The rest of the places, they pretend that, you know, they're fearlessly seeking the
truth. Oh, yes. Bill O'Reilly.
What they're really doing is just
Bill O'Reilly,
the case between the ads.
I'm sorry to say that I think you're 100% right on this. But so the mainstream media was very, very slow to pick this up. There were just tiny little coverage as if it was a little kind of doodad on the British election that, oh, yeah, well, by the way, you know, there's been this leak. That was really the sum total of the coverage for a while. But there's been a lot of agitation both on the web, so part of this is the power of the Internet. But part of it is Congressman Conyers. You mentioned some congressmen were leading an investigation, and I wondered if you might comment on that.
Absolutely. First of all, I should say that you're quite right to point out the agitation online and elsewhere about this. You know, when I say that the media just exists to make money, it's not really the end of the story. You know, sometimes, under some circumstances, they will make an effort to do what you would like them to do. And if they think they can make money doing it, and also because the people working within the media do want to do a good job, or at least some of them do. The more people can complain and make noise and write letters and agitate, the more space the people sort of within these institutions who want to do a good job have to operate. So it's very, very important for people to keep writing letters, to keep involved and say, you know, we want to hear about this. You know, we'll buy your newspaper tomorrow morning if you write a story about it.
So that's a very good point.
Now about the Conyers hearings, these hearings are being held this Thursday. They've been organized by John Conyers, who is the
congressman from Michigan,
senior Democrat on the Judiciary Committee.
Right.
And there are several guests who are confirmed as of now. Ray McGovern.
He's been a guest on Left Out.
A longtime CIA analyst, now retired. You probably know he's been writing about these issues and his anger at the manipulation of intelligence for some time.
There's a wonderful chapter by him on your website, afterdowningstreet.org, which I recommend.
That's right. Along with these memos, that's also in the left-hand column.
And we've had Ray McGovern on this program as a guest a few months ago.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Cindy Sheehan.
I don't know that person.
His son was killed in action in Iraq.
I see.
We'll be there to talk. Joseph Wilson.
We know him.
Who many people probably know about as well.
Yeah, and his wife was there was a major felony committed by the White House in outing his wife to Robert Novak.
That's right. And John Boniface, who is a well-known, very respected constitutional lawyer, will be talking about what he believes should be the next step by people in Congress. And that's essentially what After Downing Street is about. It's not to say, you know, we don't like George Bush and he should be impeached right now. We're saying simply there is enough evidence that a resolution of inquiry should be introduced and this should be investigated in a serious way.
So I understand Congressman Conyers plans to deliver a petition that our listeners may wish to sign.
That's right. I would urge people to go to John Conyers' website, which is johnconyers.com. His name is J-O-H-N, John. Conyers is C-O-N.
Y-E-R-S.
Y-E-R-S, yes.
There's a link on the leftout.info website for the program today.
Okay, wonderful. And this is a letter that is simply asking President Bush very basic questions about the Downing Street memo, the main one. And it has been signed by John Conyers, as well as, I believe at this point, 90 other members of Congress. Thanks to help from Move On, it has now been signed by over 500,000 just regular U.S. citizens, including myself, and I hope you guys, too.
Including me, including Dan.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yes.
Excellent. And anybody who is interested in this issue at all should go check it out, sign the letter, and after the hearing, Congressman Conyers will be taking the letter directly over to the White House in person with the boxes and boxes full of signatures by people saying, you know, we want the president to answer these questions.
Great. So that's good. So thank God for heroes like John Conyers. I don't know where we would be without him.
Yeah, I would also urge people, you know, congressmen, they seem like they're very far away. They're people, too. Absolutely, you know, write to Conyers, write to his staff and tell them, we appreciate what you're doing. You know, we think it's important, and the fact that you guys are, you know, working 24 hours a day is something that's inspiring and it's appreciated.
So we're talking to John Schwartz, who represents AfterDowningStreet.org, which is an organization devoted to bringing forth the information behind the Downing Street memo, the memoranda themselves, associated documents, and helping to support the effort to for there to be an inquiry about what really went on in the run-up to the Iraq War. Why did we really invade Iraq? Which things were true, which things were false? How much of this was a pretense? And what are the true motivations, I would ask, for us invading Iraq? So I wonder, another point that Danny raised earlier, and if, listeners, if you wish to call us, you can call at 412-268-9728 or send mail to Bob at leftout.info. So Danny, you mentioned, when talking about the press, you mentioned an article by Michael Kinsley, which is in the L.A. Times, if I'm not mistaken.
No, well, he works for the L.A. Times, but uh-huh. He wrote a piece that appeared in the Washington Post kind of dismissing the memo as unimportant and why the media was justified in ignoring it and so on. It's a rather long op-ed piece. I wonder if maybe John would like to comment on that article.
Sure. You know, I of course read that too, and I think people who read it besides you guys and me will be angry about it, angry like I think all of us were. It's very sad to see Michael Kinsley, who I think everyone would agree is a pretty smart guy, form these sort of transparent and just silly apologies for the Bush administration, and it's impossible to understand exactly why he's doing this. I mean, nobody knows what's in anybody else's
mind. So you could summarize his argument, perhaps?
His argument was that, you know, finally after being bothered by all of these crazy people, he is going to mention the Downing Street memo, and that what these crazy people don't understand, and I think he refers to people who think that this is important as being paranoid.
That would be us.
Yeah, that's right. you know, and what they don't understand is that this really isn't news. because everybody knows that George Bush had decided to go to war, you know, long before the war had actually happened, and everybody knows that the intelligence was fixed, and why make such a big fuss about it? So, you know, what's so strange about Kinsley is he's saying, like, there are all these people who are paranoid because they believe something that's true.
Yeah.
You know, he basically accepts that all the people writing to him are right.
Yeah,
but he just doesn't think it's worth.
But only nutcases are interested in the truth.
Yeah, but only nutcases are interested in the president possibly lying to start a war.
So
I think probably he would care more about it if he had children who might have
some skin in the game. Yeah,
exactly.
I know what you mean. Jonathan, we have a caller on the line. Caller, would you go ahead, please? Hello? Well, maybe we don't.
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay, please, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, John. This is Aaron Datesman in Squirrel Hill.
You guys know each other, okay.
Yes, we do. I'm a big fan of John's website.
Oh, great.
And we've been friends for a while.
Okay, good.
I want to know how you get 20 Republicans to vote for the resolution of inquiry. Or however many you need.
Well, that's a good question, and I wish I had the answer. I mean,
so the reason for asking this question, would you please clarify the context of the question? Why? Where this 20 comes from? Why do you need 20?
Well, I guess to have a resolution of inquiry,
to
you
get
would
enough
need
votes.
To pass it in the Congress,
right? To get enough votes, right? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that things can change very quickly in politics, and politicians, you may have noticed, have a tendency to sort of keep their fingers to the wind and see which way the wind's blowing. And if there is enough pressure, I don't think it's crazy to believe that you could find 20 Republicans who might vote for this. It would take a lot of pressure, and you know, it would probably take gas prices going up,
yeah.
George Bush becoming, you know, even more unpopular than he is now. But you know, politicians will ditch the people that they have loyally followed up to a certain point. Maybe if we lost Aaron?
No, we're okay.
I think we lost Aaron. We just need to lose his phone,
lost Aaron.
Phone line, and then we can...
There we go. Sorry about that, Jonathan. Go ahead.
But I don't think that it's crazy. I think that, you know, there are some Republicans... I mean, I know just from hearing what people are talking about on Capitol Hill, that there are Republicans who are very concerned about this, who are hearing from their constituents. So people who are represented by anyone who's the Republican should be contacting them and saying, you know, I want you to pay attention to what John Conyers is saying, and if a resolution of inquiry is introduced, you know, I want you to vote for it. Also, we should keep in mind that there is an election in 2006, and things like this take a very long time, and it is possible that the Democrats will win back one of the houses, either the House of Representatives or the Senate, and that would really make things very, very different. Controlling parts of Congress really gives you much, much more power than when you're in the minority.
Yeah, So we hope to keep the pressure on, and I'm really grateful for you and for your organization, AfterDowningStreet.org. For helping to propagate all of this information about what's been going on with the Iraq war and hopefully helping us to see that something is done about it. Well, thank you very much for calling in, Jonathan, and I'm sorry for the difficulties with the making the connection, but I think it all worked out well in the end.
All right, my pleasure.
Thank you very much for calling. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back in a few moments.